Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday right here on Mind Talk. Thoughtful Thursday is the day that you and I focus on new learning and expanded learning with conversations and guests who challenge us to think more broadly, more wisely, more thoughtfully. Every day, you and I have the opportunity to hear from someone else who is willing to share his or her story, expertise, all in the service of adding to our ability to engage in critical thinking for ourselves. I'm very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Dr. Kathy Groover. Kathy is the television host of the Alternative Medicine Cabinet, and she's also the author of an award-winning book of the same name. With over 20 years of health experience, and we'll ask Kathy about that in a moment, she is a frequent guest on TV and radio, and she's written tons and tons of articles. Kathy Groover, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Dr. Groover, tell us a little bit about your background. I've just told folks that you have over 20 years of health experience.
Yes, this is all very accidental. I never set out to be a health practitioner. I actually started out as an actor, which has nothing to do with health at all. And it was very accidental. I started apprenticing with a massage therapist when I was in college. And I sat there every day with her and I watched what she did. And finally, one day she turned to me and asked me to help her. And I said, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm an actor. And she looked at me and she goes, you know what you're doing. And I thought, okay. And I had the sense to listen to her. And that started me on the trail of following these breadcrumbs of people introducing me to different modalities and introducing me to different health concepts. And so I started doing massage, geez, probably about 25 years ago now. And I've been doing that since. And I started doing hypnotherapy and got my PhD. And I realized that people showed up at my office looking for more info than just what was my elbow going to do to that muscle that day. You know, they wanted to know about their uncle's heart disease and they wanted to know about their kid's autism. So my love of that learning was really fueled by their curiosity as to how I could help them more. So I just kept studying and then writing and then doing a lot of expert work in radio and TV, and which brings me here. And I really feel like I just, like I said, followed the breadcrumbs of my own curiosity and that love of learning and brought me here.
Well, now, Kathy, you've got a lot of letters after your name. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have a PhD in natural health. I have a doctorate as a traditional naturopath. I don't normally put that one on there because those rules vary state by state, and it's just easier to leave it off than to explain what it is. I have LMT, which is licensed massage therapist, or licensed massage technician, again, depending on what state you're in. I'm a certified hypnotherapist, so that's on there. And then I'm also a Reiki master, and Reiki is a hands-on healing technique, which heals on all levels of body, mind, and spirit. And we abbreviate that as RM, which is very funny because I had someone pick up my business card a few years ago and look annoyed. And I said, what? And she goes, you have a typo on your business card. And I thought, oh my God, I do? Because I'm a Capricorn. I tend to not have typos on my business card. And I said, what's the typo? And she said, well, it should say RN. And I said, well, I'm not a nurse, so it actually shouldn't say R. I know what my own initials are. She was just so annoyed thinking, because she didn't know what RM was. She thought I had actually put a typo on my business card. So, yeah, got to educate her a little bit on that one.
You appreciate new learning, and you had the opportunity to share some.
I do. I love it. I read medical books for fun, so it's always funny on Facebook. People are like, you know, what book are you reading now for fun? And I'm reading a book on, you know, adrenal fatigue or stress in the immune system or, you know, all this stuff, just because I'm obsessed with it. I love it. And to me, the more I know, the more I can help other people, whether it's people in my office or people on your show.
Absolutely. Well, today what we're going to be discussing is your recent publication, Conquer Your Stress with Mind-Body Techniques. But before we launch into that, you just talked about being a Reiki master. And, you know, we hear about that, but we don't know what that is. So what exactly is the practice of, is the Reiki practice?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because there is a lot of misconception about that. And it's funny because I'm very I'm very serious when I do my work. I mean, I love to laugh, but I take my job very seriously, and I'm not woo-woo at all. I don't do that sort of, you know, quote, airy-fairy stuff. But when I explain Reiki to people, they suddenly go, that's a little woo-woo. So bear with me on this one. We'll get to the explanation of why this works.
Okay.
It's a hands-on healing technique, and it uses universal energy, that chi, that universal life force, whether you want to call it Christ consciousness or universal love, whatever that is, and it goes through the practitioner and into the person on the table. So by simply putting my hands on people, that energy starts to flow. And I have seen this do amazing things for emotional and spiritual health. I have had people come to me. There was one woman who had just lost a child, and she was a complete, as you would imagine, emotional wreck, mm-hmm. spiritually devoid. And by the time she left my office an hour later, she looked like a completely different person. I've seen it speed wound healing. It helps bone breaks heal quicker. And where I explain to people this is not woo-woo and out there is the fact that I have never been to a cancer center that doesn't offer Reiki treatments. And about 90 hospitals around the country offer Reiki as an addition to what they do in the hospital. Those types of facilities are not going to offer that type of treatment if they're not seeing some sort of benefit and effect from it. So
very true.
There's been a lot of studies done on it that it really does help speed healing. In fact, I had had the unfortunate event of getting a steak knife in my hand, which is not fun at all, definitely not fun as a massage therapist. And I sat there and did Reiki as I was waiting in the emergency room, you know, that eternal wait to have someone stitch up my hand. And by the time I got in to see the doctor, he said, why did you wait so long to come in here? And I'm thinking, I've been sitting in your waiting room. And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, I mean, this looked like this happened hours ago because it started to heal so quickly. They basically had to open up my hand to stitch it up because I healed it too fast. So things like that, you know, you have to be careful you don't heal yourself too quickly. But Reiki is an amazing technique. Usually it's not massage. You usually stay clothed and you lay on a table and people put their hands on you in different positions or slightly above you. And it's an amazing, it's a beautiful modality. I love it.
Well, I may have to come back and talk to you more about that because you're right. I mean, there's so many misconceptions about what that is that I think a lot of people, if they don't understand, they just sort of blow it off. So,
right. And it's also, you know, it really depends on the practitioner because I had someone come to me for Reiki and after the session, they opened their eyes and they said, was that it? And I said, yeah, how do you feel? And he goes, well, I feel great, but there was no dancing. I said, what? And the last person he had been to with Reiki took it to this very, I mean, like very out there extreme, according to this man. And the guy like danced around the table and chanted like through stuff. And I said, no, that's not how I do it. So it also depends on the practitioner. Some really want to take it to that extreme of making it this very ritualistic sort of out there thing. And, you know, me like myself, I just sit in my office and I do my thing and it's pretty quiet. And, you know, so it also, it's very practitioner dependent. So if you don't like how practitioner A did it, find somebody else. There's always someone else to do it.
That's good advice. All right. So we've already planned to have a return visit. Now let's get back to what we were going to talk about to begin with, which is how to conquer stress with mind and body techniques. I was struck by a comment that you made early on in this book where you say stress, it's not the problem.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, we can't get away from stress. We're surrounded by it. We can't stop it. We can't control it. It's going to happen to us, whether it's the traffic jam or the IRS audit or the slip and fall down the stairs or the breakup or the death in the family. We can't avoid any of that. So then it's not the problem because we can't stop it. What we can control is our reaction to that, our response to how we deal with those things once they do happen. So that's what my book talks about. It doesn't tell you how to decrease your stress because we can't. I mean, to a certain extent we can. We can, you know, make different choices and have lists and say no to things in that practical sense. But really the key is finding techniques that work for you, the individual, to help you manage your response when that stuff happens. And so that's what I share in this book.
You know, there's another important point that you make very early on, and you talk about the fact that, you know, stress means different things to different people. And again, it's almost like the mini conversation we just had a moment ago about Reiki. Because people have such differing views of what it actually means to experience stress, I'd like for you to tell us what you mean when you talk about stress and how to heal with mind-body techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it is a very individual thing. I'm very type A. I'm very go, go, go. I live my life with a very full schedule, and I like that. It feels good to me. It's not uncomfortable. I have a girlfriend who, if she has one thing on her to-do list that day, that's the most overwhelming thing for her, and she has to rest afterwards. So we all have a different stress hardiness, and I think we kind of shoot out of the womb that way, but I also think that's learned over time. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, if you want to get technical, you've got things like birth order, and you've got things like zodiac signs, and, you know, we can pull in anything that gives you a hint as to what our personal stress response is. But I think you have to identify what your stress level is comfortable at and keep it in there. If you don't like roller coasters, don't get on the roller coaster. If you don't like having a crazy busy schedule, do your best to not schedule it that way. And then you have to find techniques that work for you. And that's one of the things I love about complementary alternative medicine is it's so customizable for the person. Because my idea of relaxing might be very different than your idea of relaxing. And not everyone has to do yoga. You know, I hear this all the time. Oh, you should do yoga. Why? Because you do, or because you heard on TV it's good for you, or, you know, not everybody falls into that category of liking yoga. So to me, the other reason I wrote this book is to give people a buffet of options, because there's endless ways that we can relax and help us manage that stress response. And so I just want to give people choices so that they know they have different ways of handling it.
So don't judge your experience of stress by somebody else's experience of stress. Really pay attention to you.
Exactly. And I think that there comes a mutual respect with that as well, because I've had times where I've had clients in my office who are completely freaking out because they're so busy. Or I had one woman, I still have a full-time massage practice, and she messaged me in the morning and said, "Do you mind if we move my appointment up a couple minutes? I'm leaving town and I'm trying to pack." I said, "Yeah, absolutely." So she came 15 or 20 minutes early, and she walked in the office, and she was clearly frazzled, as if she was, like, literally leaping on a plane at that moment. And I said, "Oh, I'm glad I could see you a little earlier. When's your trip?" "Next Wednesday." And I thought, and that stresses you out. I mean, literally, she had like a week to pack, and she had it in her mind that she had to do it at that moment, and she was completely freaking herself out. But to me, leaving next week, that's not stressful. I have 4 trips in the next month coming up that don't, you know. So we all have to. And I could have berated her for that, or made fun of her for that, or, you know, we have to respect where other people are too. So if that stresses her out, I don't know why that stresses her out. It wouldn't stress me out, but I have to respect that it stresses her out and not make that a negative thing from my perspective.
Right. And you have to, again, in respecting it, you're believing that that is her experience of stress, and you're not casting a judgment on it one way or the other.
Exactly. I might not get it, but I can't discount it.
Exactly. And so many people, as you well know, if they don't get it, there's a tendency to discount it as though it's not real or true. And that's no good for either party.
Right, exactly. And then because we have this different perception of stress, we think that our way of handling our stress is going to work for that other person. I have a girlfriend who her idea of relaxing is laying in a chaise lounge. And she lays there. And she doesn't do anything. And I think, are you being punished? Did they put you in time out? Why are you forced to sit there? That is not relaxing to me. That would drive me crazy. I want to go to a dance class, or I want to go do flying trapeze, or I want to go see a show or go wine tasting, you know. And she's happy to lay there. That doesn't work for me. So if someone made me relax that way, it's a punishment. No, it doesn't work. So we have to look at our own individual needs and respect those.
So it sounds like if somebody tried to make you relax that way, that in fact would add to your stress.
Exactly. Unless I have a book and a highlighter, and then I'm okay.
You give a list of warning signs of stress. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go through the whole list, but there are some things that I would like to go through, because I think people don't often recognize that there might be a correlation between, for example, back pain, tight neck and shoulders, and stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We have this response in our body. It's that fight or flight response, which is great. It allowed us to survive as a species this far. The problem is we don't now have a bear chasing us. We have all this ongoing stress. And, you know, people talk about having the weight of the world on their shoulders, and I can't shoulder this burden. I talk about those types of phrases later in the book. But, you know, when we're stressed, our shoulders tend to creep up towards our ears, and we start to get tension headaches. And there's this pain-stress cycle where if you're in pain, that tends to induce a stress response. But when you're stressed, it makes your muscles tighten. So it's that endless cycle until you break that cycle. And oftentimes the best way to do that is physically, and of course, since I'm a massage therapist, I think we should all be getting massage. But there is that great way of helping stop the emotional, spiritual stress by going from the physical body and vice versa. Sometimes that stress is so embedded in our physicality mm-hmm. that even if we stop the external stress, our bodies, it takes some time. You still have to do the body work and the chiropractic and the, you know, sleep well and all that sort of thing. But I think there's a huge connection between that physical muscular stress, tension and the stress that we're experiencing outside of ourselves.
Well, and again, just with the physical symptoms, and you break down the warning signs of stress in four categories, but mm-hmm. staying with the physical symptoms for a moment, there are some that you've identified that it's relatively easy to say, yeah, that sounds like that could be a stress reaction. But indigestion and dizziness, I don't know that that's something that folks would experience and say, this could be a stress reaction.
Right. Absolutely. Well, especially with the indigestion, there's a huge connection between stress and our digestion. In fact, one of the hallmarks of the fight or flight response is releasing what's in our bowels. Because if we're running from a bear, we're not digesting food right now. All that ceases. So if we're having this ongoing low-grade stress or high-grade stress, our digestion is going to be affected by that. If we eat upset, if we eat sitting in front of the TV watching the news, especially these days, you know, it can be very stress-inducing. Our body is made to eat in a very relaxed, calm state. So if we're upset, the digestive enzymes aren't going to work as well. We're going to end up with either diarrhea or constipation, and those are the symptoms of IBS. And IBS is considered a very stress-related disease. So, you know, we look at what our ancestors way back, you know, when we were actually needing that true fight or flight response, what benefited them is now detrimental to us if we have long-term stress. And the dizziness, there's dizziness associated with things like adrenal fatigue, depression. It's just, again, the blood flow in the body and we're not breathing. We tend to not breathe as well when we're stressed. People who walk around sighing all the time or taking that big gasp of air, they're typically holding their breath, and that's a sign of stress. So, yeah, there's so many things that we don't normally think about that are coming out of that stress response.
And you just referenced IBS, meaning irritable mm-hmm. bowel syndrome.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the behavioral symptoms.
Uh-huh.
You talk about the compulsive gum chewing.
Yeah.
Explain that one.
Well, it sort of goes along with the smoking. It's that nervous habit of needing something to do with yourself, whether you're doodling or you're tapping your foot or you're chewing gum or you're chewing the inside of your lip or you're making some sort of weird sound with your mouth. You know, that is your body trying to blow off steam. That is your body trying to release tension. And if you know anybody who has quit smoking, oftentimes suddenly what they're doing is they're either eating or they're chewing gum. It's that soothing mechanism. We're trying to self-soothe at that point. So people who are going through a lot of gum, probably having some stress going on.
Interesting. And talk to me about edginess and being ready to explode.
Yeah, that is, if you look at an animal, and we were talking before we got on the air, I've got cats, before they either play hard or they attack each other, what do? They sort of pace around and they make themselves look big and they get that agitation. Dogs do that too. Animals do that too. If you look at fighters before they get in the ring or football players on the sidelines, that's what they're doing. They're pumping themselves up. They're trying to blow off that steam, which is great if you're about to have a sports competition where you are going to blow off that steam. It's not good if you're heading into a meeting with your boss where you can't punch him in the face. We have this ready to pounce feeling, but we can't expel it anyway. And that just starts to build up in our body and then becomes those physical symptoms or those, you know, the muscle tension or the heart disease or the indigestion or the ulcer. We have to find a way to let that stress out. We have to find a way to release that energy. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people, especially men, I hate to say that, are stuffing that feeling and not getting it out.
Well, you know, I certainly think in a lot of ways that men have really been socialized to not feel what they're feeling. I do think it's changing over time. What's your thought?
I agree with you. I think we're seeing a lot more of men being allowed to get in touch with their feelings. We're not in the 1950s anymore where the man's the provider and the woman stays home demure and takes care of the children. Unfortunately, now that means that now the woman's trying to take care of the children and she's out in the workforce. And, you know, we've been told we can do it all and we're trying to, which we can't always. But no, I agree with you. I think we're starting to see this revolution of more sensitive men. And maybe it was the whole metrosexual thing that happened, a decade ago when men were allowed to comb their hair and tuck on their shirt and not swear. And they were still considered masculine. There's vast generalizations, of course, but yeah, no, I agree with you. I'm seeing a shift in that as well.
It's amazing what we as a society can do to each other within this society. Dr. Kathy Groover is author of Conquer Your Stress with Mind and Body Techniques. We're going to take a break, but we'll be right back, so don't go away. Under cognitive symptoms, and again, you list several, but I just want to ask you about one, which is the lack of creativity. I don't imagine that folks would naturally think about that as a potential sign of stress.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that depends on your personality and what your job is. My husband's a writer, and when he's under stress, it's probably harder for him to write. It's that writer's block thing. One of the things that decreases when we're in a stress state, and again, going back to that very basic fight or flight response, you don't need to have creative thinking when you're running from a bear. You don't need to be drawing or making up stories when you're about to go into battle. Your cognitive function, your memory, that part of the brain kind of goes to sleep a little bit when we're in a really heightened state of stress. So at that point, you know, you're not going to be as creative. You're not going to be as good with your memory or your communication skills or your cognitive function because the brain shuts that part down. We don't need that when we're in a stressful state.
So again, in fact, what we're looking at is the reality that stress means different things to different people, and it shows up in different ways with different people.
Absolutely. I mean, because I'm sure there's writers down in Hollywood who, you know, have to go on the air with Saturday Night Live in 10 minutes and they haven't finished that skit yet, and that pressure actually fuels them to be more creative. I'm sure there are people who have that, you know, they love to work on a deadline. They love to have that pressure. That actually helps them. A lot of people, it doesn't, though. So again, you know, these are pretty individualized.
You say that America is sicker than ever, which is kind of a scary thought. But then you say something really interesting, which is that placebo treatment has been seen as being effective for specific ailments like pain, depression, skin conditions, and asthma. Uh-huh. So on the one hand, if we're sicker than ever is what you're saying. But on the other hand, and I'm going to ask you to go more into what a placebo treatment is, uh-huh, but with the fact that placebo treatments are seen to be effective, while we may be sicker than ever, we're more aware of our own internal ability to heal ourselves.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I think a certain segment of the population for that's true. So many people still turn to their doctor for everything, and that's great. I'm so glad we have Western medicine. But there's a lot of shirking of responsibility, I believe, and that, you know, people aren't doing their homework with that. They're not following the doctor's orders, or they're not following their practitioner's orders. They just want to be very passive in that care, and they want to go to the doctor as if they're a car and say, fix me. we have to take responsibility for that. And one of the things that's really interesting about placebo is, you know, we've been using placebo for centuries, whether it's a sugar pill or an injection that doesn't really have anything in it, or they did an amazing study with placebo effect and people with Parkinson's who had had the brain stimulator inserted into their skull, and they gathered all these people with the brain stimulator and they said, hey, you know, we're going to be doing some maintenance on the stimulator. We are going to have to adjust some settings. So we're going to have to turn it off for about 10 minutes. Don't be surprised if your symptoms get worse, but don't worry, we'll turn it right back on. Okay, get ready, we're turning it off. And the shuffling gait would happen and the face would droop and the language would be not as good. But they didn't actually turn it off. They just said they turned it off. And then after about 10 minutes, they'd say, okay, we're going to turn it back on. You'll be fine again. And they'd, quote, turn it back on, and all the symptoms would disappear again. So we have an incredible ability to adjust physiology from something that's not actually physically happening to us. And they've done study after study about that. And there's a gentleman at the University of Turin named Fabrizio Benedetti, who actually endorsed one of my books. He does amazing research on the placebo effect and how we might use that to actually boost our own healing.
And again, you know, with the there are some folks who, as they hear about the impact of the placebo effect, will turn that into a negative and say so-and-so was just pretending or they were just making this up, when in fact that's not true at all. The folks who are reacting to a placebo, which is, as you've described, it's not what they expect to be given to them. It's what they, but they respond to what they expect to be given to them. These folks are not aware of the fact that it's a placebo, and they're not aware of the fact that what's really changing their experience is what's going on in their own brain.
Right, absolutely. Well, but also our brains do not understand the difference between what we're thinking about and imagining and what's actually happening to us. This is why we can get so into a movie and, you know, we're yelling at the person in Friday the 13th saying, don't get in the car, they're in there. You know, I mean, we can get so emotionally involved in a film. That's not happening to us. You know, who can watch certain movies and not cry because the person dies or they leave each other for war? Or, you know, we are emotionally affected by that because our brain thinks it's happening. We think we're there. Same thing with dreams. Same thing if I have you guys all imagine the worst day of your life, moment by moment, you're going to start to have a stress response. You're going to start to experience that. Please don't do that. This is why things like visualization and affirmations and the placebo effect can work. And there's a misconception of the placebo effect that, oh, well, these people must have, you know, they must be low IQ or they must be kind of dumb or they must be low income or, you know, whatever it is. There is no study that they have shown that has a distinction between any kind of socioeconomic group and who is susceptible to the placebo effect. It's across all boards, men and women, highly intelligent, rich or poor, black, white, Hispanic, it doesn't make a difference. About 30 to 40%, and this number's been debated, of the population is susceptible at any given time to the placebo effect. If we can use that for healing and it is less invasive and it uses less pain meds, why not do it, you know?
Speaking of being less invasive, you also talk about the many physicians who are recommending affirmations, positive mm-hmm. affirmations for healing cancer and HIV. For healing cancer and HIV, that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's something that's overlooked. Now, I am not in any way saying sit at home and tell your cancer to go away and don't go to your oncologist. I would never tell. I'm not that irresponsible. But if it helps, you know, if it helps 10%, if it helps shrink that tumor, just like I was talking about Reiki, it can help speed healing. This is why they're doing Reiki in cancer centers. If it can help shrink your tumor, if it can help get your symptoms to go away, if it allows you to feel better about what's going on, and again, it's that very first thing we talked about when we started the show, we can't stop the stress. It's going to happen. So rather than having a negative reaction to it, to something that we can't control, we can sit there in traffic and we can yell and scream about the fact that there's cars in front of us and they're not moving and there might be an accident ahead. We can't move those cars. So why not take that opportunity to do the best thing we can do for ourselves, which is remain positive. The thing I do now in the car, and I'm in Santa Barbara in California, so we don't have tons of traffic, but occasionally we do. We have a lot of older people, so we have a lot of slow drivers. I'm a little fast driver, but if I'm sitting at a red light, I take my hands off the steering wheel, I put them in my lap, I breathe for a while, and I do a mini meditation. I think I am at peace, or I'll think about positive things, or I'll look around me at the beautiful environment, and I'll really think, well, that's a really beautiful tree. And then suddenly the traffic's cleared, the light is green, and I'm moving again. Why not take any opportunity we have to remain positive? And that's a lot of what they're doing with the affirmations and the visualization.
And, you know, when you can really be in the moment, which is certainly what mindfulness speaks to, it does reduce your stress because all these things that you are making larger than large all of a sudden become very small and not as important because you're thinking about what is really true in that moment right now.
Right. Absolutely. And also, if you look at stress, it's usually not in the here and now. I do a lot of workshops and training with 911 dispatchers and first responders. They're actually in a stress state right then. Most of us aren't. You know, we're dwelling on things from the past. Oh, I shouldn't have said that to my boss. Or we're worried about things in the future. Oh, my God, what if he breaks up with me? What if that lump is cancer? What if I get audited again? What if what if I'm late for that meeting? What if my hair doesn't turn out right? You know, we're thinking about these things in the future. Whereas if we just stay here and now, there's typically not stress. Even the traffic isn't about right now. It's about where we should have been 5 minutes ago or where we're supposed to be in 10 and we're not going to make it. It's not about this present moment. So using things like mindfulness and meditation and staying here in the here and now, you're absolutely right, it eliminates so many of our problems.
Well, you know, it's extraordinary how skilled we are as human beings to, you know, sort of fill our minds with guilt from yesterday or scare ourselves with what hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. And 9 times out of 10, that thing in the future we're worried about isn't going to happen anyway. Mm-hmm. And I had the privilege of studying with Thich Nhat Hanh at Harvard. And one of his, he had brought a bunch of the monks who train with him. And one of the sisters was doing a workshop for us. She was just an amazing woman. And she said, anytime we're not in this present moment and we're worrying about the future, whether it's what is this diagnosis going to be in the future, or what if, you know, I die, or what if there's an earthquake, or what, you know, all these what ifs, why suffer twice? You know, when we get the bad news, that's going to be enough suffering. Why are we spending the entire weekend leading up to that doctor's visit worrying about this negative thing that we don't even know is going to happen? We'll suffer enough when we get that news. Why suffer twice? Or all week long, or all year long? Why put ourselves in that place? You know, we're meant to be happy and joyous in this present moment, and so often we're kind of ruining that by projecting into something that we don't even know is going to happen.
Well, again, you're absolutely right. You gave an interesting example of the profound effect that words have on our emotional sense of self, physical sense of self. I'd like for you to talk about the story of your client who really helped to bring you to this awareness. And you talk about your frustration with being unable to help her with her hand and wrist problems. Talk about that experience with her.
Yeah, this was really my first big illustration of how much stress and those words, that mind-body connection affected us. Because I was a massage therapist, my job was the body, period. I didn't have a lot of deep conversations with clients about their stress because it didn't strike me to do that. This was years ago. And this woman came to me and she was having carpal tunnel-like symptoms. She was not diagnosed with carpal tunnel, but she was having this hand and wrist pain. And every week she'd come in, sometimes twice a week, and I'd work on her forearm and I'd, you know, research what little muscle I could release to help her hands. And they would feel better for a little bit, but then the pain would start to come back. And I was really beating myself up for this. I was in a very not the right position where I was taking responsibility for her healing, which really is, you know, I can't do that. That's up to the person. But she was doing her homework. She was stretching. She was icing. She adjusted her workstation. Everything was going along swimmingly, but this pain would not go away. And finally, during one of the sessions, in my frustration, I said, oh, okay, tell me again when this hurts you. Like, what are you doing? And she said, well, it really hurts when I grab things, like when I grip them, like my hair dryer, my glass of wine. I thought that was tragic, so we had to fix that. And I listened to those words, the grab and the grasp and the grip, and I said, well, is there something that you're gripping too tightly? Is there something that you need to let go? And her eyes popped open, and she looked at me, and she said, I don't want to let my kids go. And I was stunned, not only that she had an answer, but that she had such a profound answer. And I said, well, would you like to explain that to me? And it turns out that when she was a kid, her brother had been killed in a car crash. He had just turned 16. He got his license. He went out for probably one of his first drives and never came home. And it ripped her family apart, as you can imagine. Her parents never really recovered from it. And now her kids were like 15 and 14, and she was terrified to let them go. And she and I talked about that, and I said, you know, did you tell your kids what had happened? And she said, no, they know I lost my brother, but they didn't know how. And I said, well, you know, you might want to share that with them. I said, if for no other reason, it'll allow them to understand why you're so controlling over them. And she said, you know, that's a really good idea. So that night they sat down and she expressed to her kids what had happened and her concerns and her fears. And they looked at photos and they cried and they had this, you know, this amazing family moment. And her hand pain started to go away. And she didn't need me now once a week. It was once every other week. And then it was once every 3 weeks. And then it was once a month. And then it faded away. And I don't have, you know, a double-blind placebo-controlled study saying this worked. But I really do deeply believe, because I've seen this now with client after client after client, I believe had she not gotten rid of that last remaining bit of that emotional, spiritual pain that was being exhibited in her body, I don't know that she would have fully healed. I think I could have rubbed her till I was blue in the face, and I don't know that it ever would have gone away. So I think so often we have to explore what is that emotional component. We store all of that in our body. And we have those phrases like my hands are full, I can't get a grip, I'm gripping things too tightly. You know, I think that was a huge illustration of what was going on with her.
And, you know, it's so important to pay attention to the language we use towards ourselves. And a lot of times we just don't. Yeah. And that is so, I mean, that's what you're talking about with the conversation with your client. It was critically important for her to hear the language that she was using and then to focus on those key themes that continue to come up over and over again.
Right. And it was clearly she was ready to do it because she had an answer immediately. She didn't have to think about it. She knew what she was gripping too tightly. So it was clearly bubbling to the surface enough that it was ready to be released. It was ready to be healed. And I think it was a time, you know, if her kids were 6 and 7, it might not have been time yet. But the fact that they longed for this freedom and she couldn't give it to them because she was so afraid of losing them, and it goes back again also to that what if. What if they die in a car crash? I'm not a parent. I can't imagine that you ever get over that fear of of losing a child. You know, I went to the Middle East 2 years ago, and my father was beside himself going, please don't go. I'm going to take your passport. I'm going to call TSA and tell them you're not allowed on the plane. I mean, you know, he did everything in his power, and I'm an adult. And I finally said, Dad, you raised me this way. So if you don't like it, it's your fault. But, you know, I don't think that fear of ever goes away of losing a kid.
Absolutely not. And again, we go back to the profound impact that our mind has on our body, the profound impact that our personal language has on us physically as well as emotionally.
Absolutely. It's very important, and we do ignore it. It's estimated we have about 60,000 thoughts a day, and that 50,000 of those are negative. That's a lot of negative thoughts. And to me, that leads to negative results. And if nothing else, it leads to more and more negative thoughts because what we think forms these new trails in our brain and it multiplies. So the more positive we can be, and that's where I like the affirmations and really looking at how we're languaging our bodies and our emotions, I think we're gonna have an advantage.
Well, you know, that's a pretty unnerving statistic that you just offered. 60,000 thoughts a day and 50,000 of them are negative?
What they tell me. I have read so many sources that say that. I feel bad for the person that did the study. How do you count all those? That's a lot of pennies. 1, 2, 3.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a hell of a day.
How did we get so skilled at being so negative?
You know, I don't know. I do know that we are wired to notice negativity quicker than positivity. I found those studies when I was doing my dissertation because you figure our brain's job is to protect us and to keep us alive. It's a survival mechanism. So if you and I are doing something and I suddenly scream no, you have to respond to that really quick, whether it's don't step there, it's quicksand, or don't put your hand on that stove, or don't cross the street, or watch out, that guy's got a gun, whatever it is. If I say something negative, we have to be trained completely unconsciously to respond to that quicker. Whereas if I say something positive, you don't need to respond to it as fast. So I know that's part of it. We are wired to protect ourselves. But I also think there's people who are just wired for worry. And I've been talking to so many clients about that. I had one woman on my table who said, you know how you wake up in the middle of the night with these terrifying thoughts? And I thought, well, kind of no. I mean, it's like, you know, we've all had that, but it's not a common thing for me. And she had this thought about what if she has to get rid of her cats because her kid might be allergic. And she's literally up in the middle of the night. And talk about what ifing. I mean, she was having these horrible, like, sleepless nights. And I said, well, but you don't even know that your kid's allergic to a cat. Why are you dwelling on, you know, she just couldn't stop those thoughts. So I think some people are just set up that way. I don't know how much of it's nurture versus nature, but I've talked to so many people lately who they're just, everything's going to go to negative first. And I think we can train ourselves out of that. I think it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of retraining.
We can train ourselves out of that. And you know, what I've said so often to my own clients is how often our parents absolutely unknowingly teach us their fears, and then we take them on as our own. Kathy, yeah. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you to go through some of the phrases that have a mind-body connection, because again, I don't think people think about them in that context. We'll be right back. Kathy, there are some comments that I think are sort of almost generic in our society, and we kind of know that they have a mind-body connection. You know, you're such a headache, or you're a pain in my whatever. I mean, you can kind of get that those might have a connection. But what about phrases like, I need to stand on my own two feet?
Yeah, there are so many like that. And when I started to put this list together, and again, this all came out of that one client and the whole my hands are full, what are you gripping too tightly concept, I started asking people about phrases that have to do with body. And I searched and I Googled and I, you know, got on LinkedIn groups and said, hey, do you guys know any? And some came up that I didn't even think about, like that one. A couple others are, the rug is pulled out from under you. You're going to save face. Start off on the wrong foot. You know, whether it's we have a propensity for twisting ankles or whether we have gout in our foot or, and again, I'm not saying we're emotionally causing our own disease, but I'm saying it does seem to come out in areas that have those correspondences or someplace where we're prone to having them. And I just found phrase after phrase after phrase, and it became just fascinating to me. Everything from he has gall to my heart is set on that. Let's have a heart-to-heart talk. Heartache, heartbreak, heartfelt. My heart is open. My heart is breaking. You know, so many of these. And, you know, if your heart is breaking, are you prone to heart disease? You know, I've seen that time and time again. Or how many people who, you know, have a stressful time and a loss end up having some sort of heart incident and then depression following that. It's an interesting correspondence, and I think it's something that we have to consider when we're looking at what's going on in our own bodies.
And you know, one of my favorite words is curiosity. And I think what you're saying is be aware of your physical body and be curious about what the physical symptoms may or may not suggest, which is so different from shaming or blaming yourself or judging yourself in any kind of way.
Absolutely. And I have been to, I heard one doctor, I heard this secondhand, got really on a female cancer patient. She had breast cancer, and she was dealing with a lot of stress. Her kids took advantage of her. Her ex-husband took advantage of her. She was very much that now debatable type C personality of people who are maybe more prone of getting cancer. And he basically got in her face and said, "You did this to yourself." And I thought, oh, my God, I would never say that to anybody, let alone a cancer patient. And there's a couple of doctors out there who have written some books who that's their thing. They're basically blaming the patient for making themselves sick. Yeah. I think we contribute to our own illness, certainly. We could all take better care of ourselves, but I would never say you did that to yourself. So in looking at these phrases, I'm not in any way blaming people like you just brought up, but it's more of an awareness. And can we change that mindset? Can we change the situation or change our view of the situation to make sure this doesn't happen again? I'd be very curious now to see if that woman's hand pain ever came back. We lost touch years ago. But I'm wondering if it was a permanent change. I have no idea.
And again, what we're talking about is being aware, being mindful. And what's really hopeful, I think, and helpful about what we've been talking about today, and certainly what you've written about in many different venues, is the fact that we are not necessarily as powerless as we may think we are, that we actually do have power within us that we very often don't tap into.
Absolutely, and especially people suffering with a chronic illness. I just did a talk for the Scleroderma Foundation, and that's a very, very tough disease. It's tough to get diagnosed. There's no real good treatment for it. A lot of people feel helpless and hopeless. Those are the two hallmarks of stress. You feel like you can't change those circumstances. Well, oftentimes, again, you can't. So how can you change you? We only have three choices. If you're in a situation you don't like, you can change the situation, you can leave the situation, or you can change yourself. And the changing yourself is usually the easiest one. You can't quit your job. You can't necessarily leave the relationship. You certainly can't leave your kids. I mean, you can't leave your kids. Usually the best thing to do is to change ourself and our view of that situation. That's really where we have the most power. And that's what I try to do with all the techniques that I mentioned and all the information is you have the power to do this. You can change your focus and look at whatever you want. And there's such power in that.
Well, speaking about the techniques that you offer, and you do offer several, one of them, which you have just sort of titled Mini Number 5, is square breathing. What is square breathing?
Yeah. So square breathing, it's harder to describe without an illustration. But so let's say, there's four sides to the square. And on the inhale, you start in the bottom left corner and you draw one line up. And then you draw that top line across. And then on the exhale, you draw one line down, and then that last line at the bottom to connect. And so as you're inhaling, you're picturing that square, or actually drawing it like on your leg, drawing it on a piece of doodle paper, drawing it, some people like to draw it on the roof of their mouth with their tongue, which actually just tickles my mouth, and then I have to make horrible noises to make it go away, so that's not relaxing for me. But it's just another way of focusing. And I had the privilege of working on a stress reduction program for the military last year. And that was part of the program was breath work. And rather than just concentrating on the inhale and exhale, some people like to get a physicality into it because thoughts still intrude. And if you're picturing a square or if you're sitting in a business meeting drawing a square on your lap that no one can see, it brings you back to that present moment and you're not going to have those thoughts intrude as regularly. If thoughts intrude, you dismiss them without judgment and you go back to your task. But the square breathing is kind of neat. It's a great way to occupy your mind and your body at the same time.
That sounds like a little bit of magic.
Kind of. Nothing's disappearing except the negative thoughts.
Talk about, we kind of know that we basically tend to engage in very shallow breathing. Mini Number 1 kind of walks us through a slowed down way to breathe. Describe that if you would.
Yeah. Is that the one with the counting? I don't have that one in front
of
me.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is hard for a lot of people. I am not, it's so funny, I teach all this stuff. I'm not the best breather around. Because I grew up dancing, I breathe very shallowly. I have amazing lung capacity, but it's shallow, which is kind of contra the thought. It's an issue of not even necessarily slowing it down, but once again, having that awareness. So you might inhale on a 5 count, hold it for 5, exhale on a 5 count, hold it for 5. And it just, again, brings that awareness back to the breathing. The breath is one of the greatest ways to anchor yourself in this present moment, because the cool thing about breath is you have complete control over it, but it's also completely unconscious. You know, we can hold our breath until we either pass out or our body forces us to take an inhale again. The only other thing we can control like that is our blinking, and concentrating on blinking and blinking repetitively, that's creepy. So we'll stick to the breath, but it oxygenates the body, brings us back to the present moment. And, you know, it's really one of those great anchors for staying present and mindful in the here and now.
There is a cognitive restructuring chart that you have in Conquer Your Stress with Mind-Body Techniques. And I'm not going to go through it here, but I would certainly encourage listeners to take a look at the cognitive restructuring chart. You know, there are certainly several that one can access, but it really is amazing how when you focus without judgment and you use curiosity to identify what the physical signs are, what you're thinking, what that automatic thought is, and then move over to a positive thought to counter it. And in the beginning, many people, I've used this kind of chart with folks myself, and in the beginning, the idea of changing what is a scary negative thought into a positive thought, you know, folks can kind of look at you like, okay, you've lost every bit of your mind that you ever had. But the reality is that you really can turn it around. You really can alter the cognitions that you fill yourself with and thus begin to engage in very different breathing, healing, you name it.
Absolutely. And so much of our thinking is distorted.
Yes.
And that's the point of this cognitive restructuring. Is, you know, to my client up in the middle of the night worrying about what if they take her cats. Now, if she was going to do cognitive restructuring on that, I would start out by saying, is that a true statement? Is the doctor going to show up at your house and forcibly remove your cats? No. Does your daughter have allergies? We don't even know yet. You know, if she has allergies, is she allergic to cats? You know, if she is allergic to cats, what steps can we take? Can we wash the cats more? Can she take an antihistamine? Can we keep them out of her room? Can we vacuum every day? You know, there are things that can be done to resolve that situation. And when we have solutions, we no longer feel helpless and hopeless, and we can hopefully stop those repetitive thoughts about something that isn't true. You know, people have all sorts of beliefs, you know, this always happens to me, I'll never change, you know, this will never happen, or they're doing those what ifs. Are those true statements? Usually they're not. You know, we don't know yet. So we can do the cognitive restructuring. And I love that chart. That was provided to me by Harvard. I learned that with them when I got to study there. So it's a great section.
It's a wonderful chart. And you know, what you're talking about is people using their energy to find yeses versus using their fears to just take a dive headlong into the no's.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do that so often. We negate things and we... You know, it's that dwelling on negative stuff. And again, usually it doesn't happen. We don't know that it's going to happen, or it happened already. It's time to let it go. And we all heal in our own way. And there's a grieving process. And there's, you know, that loss process that we all have to go through with various things. But when it becomes an identity and not an anecdote, you know, I lost my mom when I was young. Typically, the only time I bring that up is to use it as an example like this of, I'm not still bemoaning that. I'm not still living in that grief state. I'm not still using that as currency, as Carolyn Mace would say, to get things. I use that as an example of, hey, you know, I lost my mom young and that fueled me getting into this type of work. It becomes an anecdote and not the identity of who I am. I don't wear a badge that says, hi, I lost my mom young. Hi, I'm a divorced woman. Hi, I'm an abused child. Hi, I'm an alcoholic. You know, we use these negative monikers as a way of identifying ourselves, and oftentimes there's secondary in that, and it's very unconscious. But I see that a lot with my clients too. They're ecstatic their back went out because then their husband vacuums. That's not a good reason to have your back go out.
It's actually a pretty excellent reason for some folks.
Well, that's true. But a better way is to sit your husband down and say, hey, you know, I really need your help. Or, hey, would you mind vacuuming once a week? Or maybe we can get a housekeeper. But to be happy that you're having an illness because you get attention. And it's normally not that blatantly obvious that there's secondary gain. But that's something else I encourage people to look at is, you know, are you benefiting from staying stuck in this place, in the stressful or negative space?
And typically, you know, if you use the word benefiting, again, folks look at you like, okay, you're nuts. But the reality is that something is creating an internal need, albeit unconscious, for you to hold on to that thing that is, on the face of it, harmful to you. There's something that's making that work for you. And again, using curiosity and maybe some deep breathing along the path so you're not so tight as you're trying to think about it, you get to learn lots of things about yourself.
Yeah. And it's scary to look in that mirror. I totally get that. If, you know, we don't want to admit that we're doing something wrong or that we're doing something detrimental or we're doing something negative or we're doing something that isn't serving us or others around us, it's really hard to hold the mirror up to that and say, oh my God, I am doing that. It's a scary place to be, because then with that knowledge comes responsibility of making a change. And those changes can be really hard and really scary. I totally get that. But in the end, the benefits that come from making those changes are gigantic for you and the people around you. And I encourage people to hold up that mirror and say, what can I do better?
You know, one of the things that strikes me about Conquer Your Stress with Mind-Body Techniques is that unlike, and you mentioned this before, unlike what so many people tend to do nowadays for reasons that are actually about another program, they look for the immediate, quick cure, the pill, the stitch, the something that will help them to deal with the symptom. Yeah. And what you're talking about throughout this book has nothing to do with taking prescription drugs. It has nothing to do with, you know, any of those sort of traditional Western medical approaches, which, again, you know, really work really well for many people. But what you're doing is walking the listener and the reader through things that they can actually take hold of themselves. It's very empowering.
Absolutely. And that's what it's about. You know, there's a difference between healing and curing. And curing, we go to the doctor for. They take out the offending part. They give us the pill. They stitch us up. We need that. But we also need the healing. And that comes from inside us. And they're not always mutually exclusive. Sometimes we find one without the other. Sometimes the person still dies from cancer, but through that they found healing. Sometimes there is no cure. Sometimes there's a cure but no healing, and then it comes back. And, you know, it's that personal responsibility. And I'm so glad we have Western medicine. I'm glad they can stitch up stuff and give us a pill when we need it. But we need to do our part, too.
Absolutely. And just, again, sort of expand our view and truly engage in critical thinking.
Yes.
Dr. Kathy Groover, again, author of Conquer Your Stress with Mind-Body Techniques, and I know you've got tons of articles in lots of different places. Is there a website or websites that folks can go to learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. There's two. TheAlternativeMedicineCabinet.com has all of my books, lots of links to past articles and shows, lots of free resources. So go check that out, TheAlternativeMedicineCabinet.com. And there's KathyGroover.com, which is my speaking site. And so if you need a motivational or stress speaker for a conference, a workshop, want me to come into your office and do things there, it's what I love doing. I love doing it. It's that acting background coming out. So that's KathyGroover.com. So, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, and, you know, connect with me, link, we'll be friends.
Okay. And again, that's Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, Groover, G-R-U-V-E-R.
Yes.
Kathy, again, the time has flown by, but thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to the Mind Talk .org website, which is myndtalk.org. The Mind Talks program is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that's Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at MindTalk. And again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.